Eric Garner went unconscious.
Cops use of a chokehold that allegedly led to Eric Garner's death.
Me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop wondering why. I was screaming at the TV.
His death not being called a homicide.
In a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes.
A Staten Island grand jury has decided not to indict an NYPD officer in the death of a man on Staten Island.
They said that they are going to be out here every night marching until they get an indictment in the death of Eric Garner. There is just as much anger out here tonight, just as much passion.
You'll see these police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard. The protesters are basically right in their faces.
Protesters in Minneapolis have attempted to shut down the city's airport this afternoon. The group representing the Black Lives Matter movement blocked two roads outside a terminal before state police ordered the group to disperse.
Back to the situation in downtown Los Angeles. Looks like protesters have moved now onto the 101 freeway in downtown.
Earlier in the day, organizers of the group promised that a demonstration involving hundreds of protesters would shut down the Mall of America.
You know, I don't remember the kind of life before what's going on. Like, you know, all of my activities have to do with basically what we call the revolution. You kind of just dive in it head first. It's like, so you can't stop. And, you know, I feel like if I stop this time, I can no longer complain about anyone that's murdered unarmed after, you know, Akai Gurley and Eric Garner and Mike Brown. So I have to keep going with this. Martin Luther King, I mean, he was in the movement for 13 years before he was assassinated. So it's not something that's going to be overnight. The significance to me of Black Lives Matter is that it's something that's nationwide. It's not just a New York problem. It's a New Jersey problem. It's across the United States. And, you know, Black Lives Matter is basically calling attention that, hey, you know, you say that all lives matter, and yes, all lives matter, but Black lives aren't mattering right now. So that's what we're trying to let you guys know is, hey, you know, hi, Black Lives Matter. You know, we're being kind of hunted, and it's a little bit of a pattern. At first, you know, people could say maybe it was a coincidence, but now it's just a pattern. And it's almost like every year there's some, you know, publicly broadcasted, you know, murder of an unarmed African-American or brown person.
Well, I moved to New York in November for work. I'm an attorney. I work in banking and financial compliance. But I've always been really active outside of work in like activists and social justice missions. I don't think people want to confront the issue that there's an issue with our system, that our police, not all of them, but there are some within those ranks, are brutalizing and terrorizing American citizens. And so I believe in our Constitution. I do believe in our criminal justice system. I think it, you know, it has the potential to be a great system, but the corruption within it and the bias within it makes it a very dangerous system for Black and brown people.
Our justice system is not corrupt. It's just very decentralized in comparison to other democratic countries. And when it's decentralized, it's based on a variety of standards for people who are part of the system. And some of the standards are not as high as we would like them to see. And then people paint with a very broad brush, extrapolating from one jurisdiction to another. Definitely we have race issues in our society, not just in the United States, in many other countries. Police officers are recruited from the society and from the community. So there's no doubt in my mind that some of the officers have various biases.
On February 26, 2012, in Sanford, Florida, Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old high school student coming home from a nearby convenience store, was fatally shot by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch captain. Martin died from a single gunshot wound to the chest. When police arrived at the scene, Zimmerman admitted that he shot Martin, but he claimed he had acted in self-defense. No charges were initially brought against Zimmerman. It was not until the shooting garnered national attention that Zimmerman was charged in connection with Martin's death. In July 2013, a jury acquitted Zimmerman of all charges. Upon the not guilty verdict, there were protests nationwide in more than 100 cities. President Obama said that he identified with the boy. Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago.
Why was it that Trayvon tended to fizzle out? Well, one reason was because you got all of that rage that was finally manifest, but it was geared toward what? Laws, stand your ground. It wasn't geared toward the powers that be. It wasn't geared toward the federal government. It wasn't geared toward the White House. It was geared toward state laws. Well, why is that so? Well, that's exactly what the powers that be wanted it to be. You see, the president's office, what did he do? He sent his own extension, who was Sharpton. And Sharpton gives a great speech, and it's all about state laws rather than police going to jail. Everybody knows that you're not going to change arbitrary police power until policemen start going to jail. Why is it that in the last 7 years you haven't had one policeman go to jail? It's the same reason why you haven't had one Wall Street executive go to jail. Because the government doesn't want them to go to jail. The government don't want to put power in that direction to go to jail. You can rest be assured, if you had a massive network of poor people engaged in gangster activity like Wall Street did with market manipulation and insider trading, those folk gonna get caught and go to jail. You can rest be assured that the police were killing well-to-do white folk. Some policemen going to jail. It's a priority. It's not a priority of the U.S. government to send policemen to jail. Not until it starts affecting them in the way it already affects many of us. And you see, some of us believe that the life of a poor black person, a poor blind person, has exactly the same value as that of a well-to-do white or well-to-do black or anybody else of the upper class.
We did have officers jailed for excessive force, especially in we had a case, an infamous case in Charleston in South Carolina, when the officer shot an individual in his back, and he's right now in prison. The judicial system is not designed to avoid prosecution of police officers, but because the standard is a standard of discretion of the individual police officer, and the standard is based on, again, individual perceptions of the situations, it appears sometimes that there is injustice because we look at this behavior in hindsight, and for us it appears as excessive, but for the officer at the given moment on the street it wasn't excessive, and the jurors frequently accept the word of the officer.
There is growing outrage tonight after an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri.
There was a struggle, and one of the men pushed the officer into his car.
Within the police car, there was a struggle over the officer's weapon. There was at least one shot fired within the car.
The struggle spilled out onto the street where Brown, whom investigators say was not armed, was fatally shot.
Police shot this man for no reason.
A little more than a year later, Michael Brown, an 18-year-old unarmed African-American man, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, a northern suburb of St. Louis. Brown, who had stolen several packages of cigarillos from a nearby convenience store shortly before the shooting, was confronted by 28-year-old Darren Wilson, a white Ferguson police officer. The disputed circumstances of the Brown shooting sparked unrest in the majority black city, and protests erupted.
Get on,
The events received considerable attention in the U.S. and elsewhere, and generated a vigorous debate about the relationship between law enforcement and African Americans, as well as the use of force by police in Missouri and across the nation.
In Ferguson, Michael Brown case, it's the word of the police officer, and we don't have any footage. The only footage that we have is what happened before at the convenience store. The footage at the convenience store is not very, positive in terms of how I look at this. It shows somebody who is acting very aggressively within the convenience store, and it gives me an indication that there was some level of violence that was displayed.
The Black Lives Matter movement focuses primarily on the experience of black men and has shaped the conversation about police brutality, where it occurs, and how it's addressed. But black women are also being killed, assaulted, and victimized by police. Women are often targeted in the same way as men, through shootings, police stops, and racial profiling. A growing number of Black Lives Matter activists, including the women behind the original hashtag, have been refocusing attention on how African American women and other marginalized communities are treated by the police. They're not only highlighting the impact racial discrimination has on their communities, but articulating why a movement for racial justice must be inclusive. Women have been at the forefront of organizing marches, die-ins, protests, and various initiatives to have their voices heard. Young African American women have been playing a central role.
Let's arrest them.
Let's
have them go before a jury of his peers,
yeah.
And let's use the system the way it's supposed to be used. Cops are not supposed to be the judge, jury, and executioner. That's the end of the story, really.
Like, say hypothetically one or two of these shootings are justified. They don't even give us that opportunity to think, critically about it, because regardless of what happens with the situation, they're not held accountable, which is the part that bothers me the most. It's like, regardless of what's happening, if it's a little boy, unarmed, kid sleeping, a grown man, selling cigarettes, no matter what the police does to them, they're not being held accountable for it.
And there's no data. That's another big issue that I think when we have the demands, because I like Esther's, her list of demands. They kind of just echo what everyone's kind of feeling in the movement. But there needs to be data, because why can't we find any, data about how many police-involved shootings, how many fatalities, how many were armed, how many weren't armed? We need that kind of information.
That's a serious issue. I think we need to really capitalize on, the momentum that we have here.
Yeah.
And definitely use that to engage the young people, because those are the people who are going to make a change. And that's why we have to do this at a local level. You know what I'm saying? We have to focus locally. And I think, our demonstrations, the vigil being one of them, is a good way to do that. You know what I'm saying? Just re-engage people at a local level and then help them to see that we can make change. So thank you guys, as always, for going out and supporting Erica night after night. We do that weekly, on a weekly basis, two nights a week. So when one of us can't get there, I appreciate that somebody is there to support her.
Yeah. She needs that consistency.
Absolutely.
On July 17th, 2014, almost 1 year after George Zimmerman was acquitted in connection with the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, Eric Gardner, a 43-year-old father of six, died of a heart attack while in police custody. He was being arrested when a New York Police Department officer, Daniel Pantaleo, put Gardner in a chokehold. Gardner was arrested on a Staten Island street corner on suspicion of selling untaxed cigarettes. After Gardner resisted being arrested, Pantaleo pulled Gardner to the ground by the neck and placed him into a fatal chokehold. In a cell phone video taken by a passerby, Gardner, who suffered from chronic asthma and heart problems, repeatedly says, "I can't breathe," 11 times in total. This video has been viewed more than 2.5 million times. A grand jury declined to indict Officer Pantaleo, and he remains with the NYPD.
on July 17th, my father was out here just like another regular day, you know, talking with his friends. That day, I was at work. I worked in Long Island at that time. I got a call from my mom. I was talking to my mom. And then about 5-10 minutes after I got off the phone with my mom, my sister calls, and she's like, you know, she don't know what's going on. She's my mom is, you know, all hysterical crying. She don't know what's going on. They just said, Dad, just stop breathing. So she started calling, you know, the hospital, trying to figure out what was going on. We couldn't get no information in from the phone. They called her and told her, you know, that it was something that went down and my dad stopped breathing. You know, she didn't know that it had anything to do with the cops until she got to the hospital. And so by the time we came to Staten Island, me, my aunt, and my cousins, you know, we drove past this part of where it happened and we seen a whole bunch of news vans and yellow tape. And we still didn't know what was going on. So we got to my grandmother's house, and that's when a reporter from the Daily News was there, and he told us, you know, it was a confrontation with the cops, and there's a video, and would you guys like to see it before it goes out on the internet? And would you give us permission to let it go out? And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop, wondering why, you know. I was screaming at the TV, because, you know, in a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes, and it was just horrible for us to see. I mean, we couldn't go into the living room and describe what we seen on the TV, on the computer, to our grandparents or to my mother, because it was so horrible. Like, I was sick that day. I mean, I just, you know, my whole body, it was just like shaky. I just couldn't believe. And then when me and my aunt was driving back to Brooklyn, we stopped over here after all the cops left and everything. And people noticed me. I'd never been to Staten Island like that. Like, I stayed in Brooklyn. But my father used to talk a lot about me and his granddaughter. And when they noticed my face, that I looked like my dad, you know, the love was just pouring out. You know, people was telling me their versions of the story, and it was just like, wow. I still can't believe this happened.
The Eric Garner case is problematic in the sense that experts in martial arts and some other people who specialize in takedowns of individuals believe that this was more of a takedown than a chokehold. Part of the problem is patrol guide or operating procedures, standard operating procedures of NYPD that were very broad. They were changing now. The use of force procedures has been changed since Eric Garner case.
A recent study on children, published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, found that black boys as young as 10 are more likely to be mistaken as being older, be thought of as guilty of possible crimes, and face police violence if accused of a crime. According to a ProPublica analysis of federally collected data on fatal police shootings, young black males were 21 times more likely to have been shot dead by police than their white counterparts. The 1,217 deadly police shootings from 2010 to 2012 captured in the federal data show that black males, ages 15 to 19, died at the hands of police at a rate of 31.17 per million. White males in the same age range were killed at a rate of just 1.47 per million.
Breaking news tonight. It was a case that sparked outrage across the nation and heartbreak here in Cleveland. 12-year-old Tamir Rice playing with a gun outside a rec center. The gun turned out to be fake, and he was shot to death by a rookie police officer who says that he thought it was real. Now the Cuyahoga County prosecutor has released three brand new reports on this shooting just within the past few hours. One is from the Highway Patrol. The other two are from experts asked to weigh in on this case months ago. They both found that the officer was justified. So who are these experts and how did they reach this decision?
In November 2014, 12-year-old Tamir Rice was shot and killed by a police officer in Cleveland, Ohio. Two officers, Timothy Lohman and Frank Garnback, were responding to a 911 call reporting that a man in a neighborhood park was walking around with what was described as probably a fake gun. Just 1.5 seconds after arriving on the scene, Officer Lohman shot and killed Rice. The boy had been playing with what was later identified as an airsoft pellet gun. A video obtained by the Northeast Ohio Media Group shows Rice's 14-year-old sister running over to her brother, being tackled and forced to the ground, handcuffed, and placed in a patrol car while her brother lay dying. The video also shows that police waited 4 minutes before providing any first aid to Rice. On June 3, 2015, the county sheriff's office released a statement saying their investigation had been completed, with their findings turned over to the county prosecutor. A grand jury later declined to indict Officer Lohman.
When we talk about law enforcement, we talk about 18,000 different police departments in the United States. Most of the departments that I'm familiar with, they don't have specific training for police officers to deal with minors and toy guns. It's mentioned during sometimes roll call, sometimes during the basic academy, that of course there's a possibility. But again, police officers are like any other people. They fear. They have fear. They have more fear probably than an average person because they also see situations that are much more dangerous and horrific than an average person. They're not taught or trained how to control their fears.
As you know, Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the Black lives that are the last ones that have value.
Even within our own nation, the consciousness has been raised. People were preaching about colorblindness. They realized that there are race issues that are still permeate our society.
I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
There is just as much anger out here tonight.
These police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard.
Again, we're seeing an African American protesters facing police in riot gear.
So we were just going over some things for the vigil. It's going to be in Nicholas Hayward Jr. Park. That's in Brooklyn. He was murdered by the police, 13-year-old murdered by the police for like really similar circumstances, very close parallel to what was happening with what happened with Tamir Rice. So it's important for me, I think, that that place be chosen and that his story be highlighted. So to that end, I'm always trying to connect the dots so that people see, yes, this is a national issue, but this is also a local issue. So his father's going to be speaking. We'll have a prayer by Pastor Omar, words from Mr. Hayward, and then I'll close out talking about the national epidemic of police violence against children. And this is why I wanted us to meet, so that we could talk about things that I may be overlooking. Well, for one, I've applied for a PIT permit with the Parks Department. You guys know that's always important to me, but I also wanted to get your input on that. We had issues with the permit with the march, lots of fighting with the Parks Department and the Police Department. And so they haven't been responsive yet, so I'm wondering if we're going to encounter the same issues that we did with the 4 Mile March. The reason why I choose places of public accommodation is because we have a legal right to be there. And so, like, you know, there's nothing that they can really do about us exercising our First Amendment right within a space of public accommodation.
I'm really glad that the weather held up.
Thank God, because yesterday was terrible.
Yeah, I thought it was going to rain.
Imagine if yesterday would have been today.
Yeah, and lugging all of this stuff in the rain, and I know it would have been a terrible turnout.
Just
but
get ponchos.
Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, people don't show up when it's rainy or cold, so I'm really glad that people have, you know, I think we're going to have a good turnout.
So I'm really excited working with Leah because, you know, you saw her. She's going to be having the weatherproof posters of the children and their stories.
She did a great job.
Yeah. I think that'll be powerful with it tied, like, on the fence so that passerbys, you know, will wonder and come and look, and then they can read the stories.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. She also did an art installation on the floor where she got age-appropriate shoes, like the whatever size their shoe size would be at the age that they were killed, and she painted those white, and those are going to be there too. So it's going to, it's going to really help you visualize how small these kids were when their lives were so.
Tamir Rice, 12 years old, playing with a toy gun in the park. The cops roll up on him, and in 2 seconds, they have killed him. 1001, 1002, Tamir is dead. And this is not an isolated incident. It happens all too often, and it must.
In September 1994, Nicholas Hayward Jr. was shot and killed in a public housing stairwell by an NYPD officer who mistook a plastic toy gun for a real one. Hayward was just 13 years old. Like so many other cases, no one was indicted in connection with the killing. In the 22 years since Hayward's death, his father has struggled with how and why his son died.
I cry a lot. It's hard to deal with losing a loved one. Nicholas was 13 years old. It pains me every time I hear of another victim being killed. My son was a great kid. He wasn't causing any harm to anyone. He was doing the right things. You know, he wasn't a danger or a threat to the officer that killed him. So, I mean, I feel that it's just something that I have to do. I have to do this.
We live in a society that continues to criminalize our youth. Despite the fact how much effort they put forward to try to make their own life better, my son was doing the best that he can prior to him being killed. And he told the officer, we're only playing. And he shot and killed Nicholas in mid-sentence. And despite all of the witnesses who's basically justified what Nicholas was doing, that he dropped the toy gun. They all told the district attorney he dropped the toy gun and the officer shot him anyway.
I think that actually there is a culture in police departments to protect each other so that when they engage in the use of arbitrary power, they come together, the code of silence, and refuse to allow us to find out exactly what goes on. And I think they also have intimate connections to the judges and others. But I would say this, though, there's no doubt in my mind that there was an epidemic of shooting of precious, well-to-do white brothers and sisters. Police would be accountable. So even given the culture of the police departments that make it difficult for accountability to take place, it's also the fact that when it comes to poor black and brown peoples, that their lives matter less than the lives of well-to-do whites. And therefore, we have to make sure that there's fair policing rather than arbitrary policing. I think fair policing is police having a relationship with the community in which they're an organic part of that community. They are fighting crime. There's all kinds of forms of criminality, including criminality in the black community, criminality in Wall Street, criminality in professional circles and so forth. But police, unfortunately, over the years, have engaged in such massive arbitrary uses of power that the distrust cuts very, very deep. And of course, it's the backdrop of wealth inequality. It's a backdrop of a capitalist system that makes it very difficult for working peoples of any color to have their humanity affirmed. It's the backdrop of a system in which the opportunities are so limited, the decrepit school system, the massive unemployment, as well as massive underemployment. So we can't overlook the larger social context of the policing that goes on in America. But it can be much more fair than it is now.
A state of emergency has been declared in the US city of Baltimore after protesters clashed with police. It follows the funeral of Freddie Gray, who died in police custody over a week ago. The National Guard say that as many as 5,000 troops have been deployed amid the unrest.
Basically, since Monday, there's been a lot of speculation about what's going on out there, but basically, Freddie Gray, as we remember, we don't know why he was arrested, but he was stopped and he was arrested. And under police custody, his spine ended up being broken and he died from his injuries. So we just need to figure out what's going on, because there's a lot of things being said. We don't know if the youth, we don't know what's going on. We know that a CVS was destroyed. But I mean, with the state of the Baltimore that I knew, I don't imagine that it could be much different from how it used to be. So I am going to head out there, see what's going on, see what I can learn from it, see how I can help, how I can support, but I just can't stay here in New York and not do anything at this point. So I'm heading out there.
Breaking news from Baltimore, a city on edge since the death of a suspect while in police custody, his spine nearly severed. Tonight, those tensions fueling violent protests now. Dramatic images coming in at this hour. You can see some people on the streets there throwing rocks and bricks at police officers.
On April 19th, 2015, 23-year-old Freddie Gray Jr., an African-American man, died in a Baltimore hospital after sustaining injuries while being transported in a police van. Gray had been arrested a week before by the Baltimore Police Department for possessing what the police said was an illegal switchblade. Gray's hospitalization and subsequent death resulted in an ongoing series of protests. On April 25th, 2015, a major protest in downtown Baltimore turned violent, resulting in 34 arrests and injuries to 15 police officers. After Gray's funeral on April 27th, civil disorder intensified with the looting and burning of local businesses and a drugstore, resulting in a state of emergency declared by Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. The Maryland National Guard was deployed to Baltimore, and a curfew was put into place.
I went there expecting the worst because I had seen the National Guard on TV and I had seen like how occupied they were by the military. So I was a little nervous when I got there, but surprisingly, it seemed that they were protecting mostly the harbor, the downtown harbor. That's where all of the National Guard really was, and it seemed that that was what their attention was focused on protecting. I think the media tried to kind of instill fear so that the same thing wouldn't happen in New York, but with Baltimore, it was the young children not feeling heard. It was mostly young children. All of the programs out there are cut for them. There's really nothing for them after school or part-time job-wise out there. So these children, they felt unheard, and their thing was to take to the streets. They were emotional. They started destroying, you know, things that they didn't feel were beneficial to the community.
The narrative around Baltimore, first of all, was that it was a riot. And I don't like that terminology because it's an uprising. It's cause and effect. When people are living in pervasive poverty and homelessness and joblessness, and on top of that, you add to that the current political climate where we see, not that it wasn't happening before, but where we see an overabundance of cops shooting and killing unarmed men, that was a natural response to to those conditions. As with every other protest that has happened throughout this country in response to this issue, there was a negative slant put on it. They wanted to paint these people as savages instead of looking at the cause and effect. And they also didn't focus on the days that preceded what they call the riot, where people were actually in the streets peacefully protesting. So, of course, they're gonna spin it.
On May 21st, a grand jury indicted several of the officers involved with Gray's arrest. But in December 2015, a Baltimore judge declared a mistrial in the trial of one officer after the jury was unable to reach a verdict. The images of police wearing helmets and masks, toting assault rifles, and riding in mine-resistant armored vehicles in Baltimore and Ferguson has also raised widespread criticism of what has been dubbed the militarization of local police forces.
The difference, I think, in the last 5 or 10 years, you've got the intense militarization of police departments. So the police department still engaged in arbitrary policing when I was growing up, but they didn't have the military equipment that they have now. And the very fact that the last 10 years or so, every 28 hours, there's a black or brown person who's killed by a policeman or security guard.
I think that military-grade equipment should be allocated to police department, but never ever used against civilians. The military-grade equipment should be used in active shooter situations, terrorist attack, but never against a civilian unrest. And I, in my mind, it was a horrible error of judgment.
We need action. By action, I mean transformation of institutions. By action, I mean redistribution of the wealth downward. By action, I mean high quality jobs, high quality education. By action, I mean high quality communities where people can live with dignity. By action, I mean police who are accountable, who are punished by law if they murder other folk, arbitrarily treat other folk in ways in which they ought not. So we're talking about just radical democracy. We need people's power. We need the sharing of power.
Unfortunately, I think that what we've seen with the killings of the officers in New York in 2014 and what we've seen in Dallas recently, unfortunately, I think that this is not the end of retaliation against law enforcement officers by certain individuals who feel that police profession and officers, no matter what department they come from, represent this oppressive and brutal treatment of minorities. After all, if somebody thinks about democracy and democratic principle and wanting to live in a democratic country, they have to realize that policing is a pillar of democracy. And if there are issues of concern, these issues of concern have to be discussed and have to be brought to the attention of the local politicians, but never, ever they should be translated into any violent behavior, especially towards the ones who overall are charged with the protection of all of us.
One major goal that we have is to tie federal funding of local police forces to a prerequisite that they provide data regarding their shootings, especially in the cases of when they're shooting unarmed civilians, and then also to tie that to the mandatory use of body cameras. So that's a huge goal because I think transparency is necessary. I don't think there's enough data out there, and so that's another reason why people are able to dismiss this issue. Another goal is to have an independent prosecutor to prosecute police when in cases of police violence, especially against unarmed people, because I think it will restore faith for those of us who have lost it in our criminal justice system. People believe that the grand jury system is antiquated and leaves police to kill with impunity. And so I think that this would be one way to help
resolve that issue.
You know, a lot of people ask me, like, why do I protest? And because it's an ongoing problem, and I can pretend that it's not going on. I can pretend that it's not happening, but there will be a new hashtag to learn. There'll be a new face the next day. And so we continue to march and move forward and get more organized and get serious, because I don't want my children to still be marching. My grandparents marched. My mother was involved in activism work. And so I don't want to pass this along. I want to be able to tell them the story of how we overcame, how we were able to come together and fight this greater evil. And just, I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
You don't know when the catalyst will be in place. Why did Rosa Parks become the catalyst as opposed to the earlier black woman who sat down on the bus just a few months earlier? It's hard to say when the spark in place takes off, the fire begins to expand, intensifies, and next thing you know, you got a whole host of people on fire for justice. And lo and behold, people take off and it becomes contagious. You don't know when it's going to become contagious. It is contagious now. We are still living in the moment of Ferguson, Baltimore, and things will continue and I hope intensify.
I was told that I'm an activist from the way that I've been doing. I never thought I would be doing this type of work. I've never been the talkative type of person, this outspoken, but this made me who I am. And, you know, this is my life mission right now, like, to become an activist, become a civil rights lawyer, you know, to bring justice some way, somehow to America. This helps me. This helps me a lot. Speaking to people and being out here is more of a support than, you know, shutting down or just crying all the time. I believe that the reforms is going to happen, but I believe that it's going to take a long time. It's going to take a lot of powerful people to be on the same page. What do I fear the most? That when my daughter get older, this will still be going on with no change.
Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if black lives matter, given the depth of white supremacy in America, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the black lives that are the last ones that have value. But the indigenous lives will matter, the Asian lives, the white lives, the brown lives, if black lives matter. That's what makes that movement so crucial. And I'm just so very proud and blessed to be an old school brother who's a small part of that movement led by young folk.
The Black Lives Matter movement, sparked by incidents of police violence, is an ideological and political movement fighting for black empowerment and equality. The movement has grown from the hashtag Black Lives Matter to include protests and demonstrations in every major city in America.